And we introduced a renormalization group technique to successively trace over spins and then rescale into an equivalent Hamiltonian. And as one does in renormalization group, looked at how the coupling constants evolved under the successive rescalings and integrating out fractions of the spin, of the spins. And so what we found in one dimension is renormalization group flow that basically says that if you start out with a large coupling constant, it flows to zero coupling constant, and nothing particularly dramatic happens. The system is always in the same phase, regardless of what the coupling constant is. Okay, so that's the result for one dimension. That's why that's somewhat of a trivial problem. And so today's talk is about lecture is about higher dimension. So let's say, for instance, two dimensions. Nicole?
Again, we're focusing on the Ising model.
Ising model. Yeah. Yeah. But that's not very important. Okay? It could be any other model that's equivalent to an Ising model, which is, as you know, many models of interest. So in any case, let's look at a higher dimension. Let's look at two dimensions. And imagine that we were going to do exactly the same thing. So for instance, we can divide this two-dimensional lattice up into the equivalent of even and odd-numbered sites. So I've divided it up into X's and O's. And you can imagine that you could start out with your partition function for the whole system and trace over all of the x's. Call them x spins. So we get an effective Hamiltonian coupling these O sites. So if you start with a Hamiltonian, which is you'd like to then, as a result of this trace, be able to define a new Hamiltonian, which would have n over 2 spins. And that would be something like this. So these would be nearest neighbor O spins, if you like. Actually, I suppose we could call them mu I, mu j. Not what I had in my notes, but let's say. And if we could do that, we'd be in business. We'd be home free, like we were in the one-dimensional case. We'd have recursion relations relating k1 prime to k1 and so forth, some constant term would come off. But unfortunately, when you do this trace over the x spins,
you actually generate, so when you trace over these two spins, you can see how you'll affect the interaction between these two. But as it turns out, you also affect the interaction between these two second neighbor spins. Okay, so it's a little bit awkward, but then you get something like K2. Call it prime. It's K1. K2 with no prime is 0. So these are next nearest neighbors. And then actually, you even get another term, which involves a coupling between all four spins around an X. That's around a mu I, mu j, mu k, mu l. And you can imagine that if you keep doing this, things could easily get worse. Okay, so basically this procedure doesn't really close. Now, yeah, Young. Well, you can see that this guy has a direct interaction between these two here, right? So when you trace over it, you know, to describe what happens on these O spins, it is as if there was an interaction between these two guys via this one that you traced over. Let me say that this calculation is the subject of your tutorial. So you'll have plenty of time to look at it. These things influence both, these two, for instance, influence both this and this. And similarly, this one influences this and this, and then the four spin, you sort of have to look at how it comes about, but you can easily imagine. Okay. Yeah, eventually, yeah. I think that's the way it works. So you can make approximations. To get closed recursion relations. And I can just give you some references. Our book, section 21.2, which is pages 556 to 564. Also, section 21.4, pages 568 to 574. Also, there's this paper, nice paper by Nauenberg and Nienhaus. Which is a FISREV letter from ...1974, which is on the wiki. So basically in today's lecture, I'm not going to go down this route. I'm going to take a different approach, which is basically what John Carty does in his book. Okay, so I'm telling you that, but that's not what we're going to do right now. See how this works. Interesting. So let's just step back for a minute and look at what we did in D equals 1. For D equals 1, K prime, as you may recall, was 1 half log cos 2K. And which is equal to 1 half log of e to the 2k over 2 times 1 plus e to the minus 4k. And if k is large, K prime is equal to, well, what's it equal to? Well, you've got log of e to the 2k divided by 2, which is k. And then you've got 1 half the log of 1 half, which is minus 1 half log 2. And then you've got other things that come from this, which are of order e to the minus 4k. And I think you can see that for large k, k prime is approximately k. But it gets smaller. Okay? So if k is, say, 100, then k prime is maybe 99.7. Okay, and as long as it stays large, all that happens as you iterate is you subtract off half log 2. Okay, so it's not really changing very, very quickly as a fraction of its size. So now you might ask yourself the question, why is k prime less than k? Actually, I thought I'd use Carty's picture for this. So Carty had these three spin blocks. Oh, S1, S2, S3, S4, S5, S6. These guys are coupled by K. And then he replaces the three spins in the block by a single block spin. And those guys are coupled by K prime. And basically what we're saying is that K prime is less than K. And so Carty argues that K prime is basically the coupling that goes through S3 and S4, which he writes as K times the average of S3 given the constraint that mu 1 is 1 times the average of S4 with the constraint that mu 2 equals 1. And even for K large, as long as it's not infinite, these things are less than 1. Okay, so it's like the effect of interaction is going via these spins, but these spins aren't perfectly ordered, even if you make the assumption of what the average direction is within the block. Okay, of course, the larger K is, the more these things are perfectly ordered, and that's reflected in the recursion relation, which says that, well, K prime isn't very different. Okay, but this is sort of the physics of that. We could have done the same thing with the two-spin blocks. We could have said something like K prime is equal to K times the average S2 with the constraint that S1 equals 1. It's just not quite as conceptually appealing. Yeah.
Express K, and now we have a brand, to express K prime, and now we have a new expression for K prime.
Yeah, and then as you may recall, I think towards the end of the class, I showed you that you get exactly the same expression for the temperature dependence or the K dependence of the correlation length, either out of the two spin or the three spin. Actually, for Carty's, I actually had this written down in my notes. For Carty, so he found that K prime was equal to the inverse tangent of tanh K cubed. Okay? That was basically his result. And if you work through the algebra, in other words, if you do exactly what I did here, what you find then is that his K prime you can work this out yourself. K minus 1/2 log 3 minus, I got 3/2 e to the minus 2k, which is in any case negligible. So when you do the three spin renormalization, then your new k prime that results from that is down by a constant additive factor, minus 1/2 log 3. Of course, you've integrated out more spins, so it gets smaller quicker in this picture. So bottom line is that the way the recursion works for large K, K is getting smaller in little steps, which will eventually turn into bigger steps. And it's because of the way that the effective coupling goes through, if you like, this one-dimensional connection. So now let's turn to the interesting question. Let's see what happens here. Oh, wow, this is so neat. So what happens? For d greater than 1. So now we have to draw the picture. So here's a picture. Let's say we have blocks like this. That are so these things are B by B. And in fact, if you're in higher dimension, they're B by B by B, or B to the D in volume. And they're going to be coupled. So everything in here is coupled by a K. But these guys are going to be coupled by a K prime. The block spins corresponding to these two blocks will be coupled by K prime. And there's a little bit of a different ingredient here. I mean, that goes via this interaction and this interaction and this interaction. And these guys might have averages that are a little bit less than 1. But the point is that for large K, which means the spins are pretty well ordered, K prime is going to go like B to the D minus 1 K, because that's the area of the interface. Okay, and that's what's really different. So the point is that even if there's a coefficient here, which because of the small thermal disorder that you have when you have large K, and it is small, so there's some coefficient out in front, which might be a little bit less than 1. B to the D minus 1 is a big number. It's like 3 in 2 dimensions and 9 in 3 dimensions and so forth. Yes, Nicole?
Well, it makes sense to me to think that the coupling constant would depend on the area of the surface between blocks that are interacting.
Right. Oh, it's correct. Well, it's correct for any k, but what I'm arguing about the limit where the spins are highly ordered. So whatever this twiddle that I have here, the question is, this represents some factor, with some k-dependent factor, which I think in the large k limit we pretty well know what it is. It's basically 1. Okay, that's. I mean, if you go to, we'll quickly say that if k is small, this factor is small. Well, this factor multiplied by b to the d minus 1 can be less than 1, and so k prime can get smaller. Okay, let's say that in this way. Let's look at how k flows. So we've got this point, k equals infinity, which, as we said, corresponds to t equals 0. And basically, what this argument tells us is that k prime is bigger than k. And so what that means is that this is flowing this way. Now, there's another point out here. And I would argue that for high temperatures, Even though you've got a large interface, the thermal disorder that disorders these spins on the boundary reduces this factor to a number less than one. And so that up here, K flows to zero. And so the point is that something has to happen in between. Okay? And what happens in between is a new fixed point, which we call K star, which is an unstable, completely unstable fixed point. And so now you can see the non-trivial case where what happens in this region on the K line is different, distinctly different from what happens down here. And if you start out with a K to the right of K star, K flows to zero. And if you start out to the left of K star, it flows to infinity. Yes, Nicole? It gets smaller because basically all the stuff that I've neglected here, which I talked about in the one-dimensional case, which is basically what, it's not just K times the number of spins, but it's sort of K times the thermal average of the number of spins on the boundary. If these guys are disordered, they add up incoherently. Okay, and so the effective coupling is reduced. I mean, you can convince yourself in any number of different ways that if you're at high temperature or small k, that the system is basically disordered and it's going to, you know, k will flow to zero. Okay, I mean, and that happens pretty much in any dimension. Okay, so for small k, that's the statement. For the same reason as it does in one dimension. So one point to this is that it's obvious from this argument that d equals 1 is special, and that d greater than 1 is qualitatively different. So now the next thing that we should address is, what is the nature of this point? Well, that's it. You don't get a K star for d equals 1. And now, so here again, I want to use an argument due to Cardy, who calls this point, says, consider some point in the disordered phase, which he calls K naught, which corresponds to some correlation length C naught, which is, he would say, of order 1, or we'll call that our unit of correlation length. So basically what this says is,
That's just saying the same thing.
The RG transformation basically gives every time you you do one RG step, your new correlation length is 1 over B of your starting correlation length. So you can imagine that you start from some K up here, and you do a succession of renormalization group transformations until you get to K naught.
Well, let me write it this way. K star less than K naught. And say that it takes n steps. Yeah, yeah, sorry. Thank you. Yeah, it's this backwards diagram here. Yeah. Okay, so some K in this region. And say that it takes N of K steps to get to K naught. Then C of K is equal to B to the N of K C naught in those units. So the point, this argument is where it's leading is that as K goes to K star, so as you take your starting point closer and closer to this fixed point, N of K gets bigger. Until your correlation length diverges as K goes to K star. Okay, so the closer you get to this fixed point, which is the point where it doesn't actually know which way to go, the more steps that it takes you to get back here. And so the correlation length that you associate with this point close to the fixed point is many, many times this, if you like, thing that we're taking as our unit of length, C naught. So let me just put it here. So this is what we mean by a critical point. This means that K star is a critical point. Okay, that it describes a critical phase transition where the correlation length is diverging, is divergent actually, infinite. Now, before we go on, I wanted to just say
a little bit about the nature of this point where the correlation length has become infinite. Okay? Because the fact that the correlation length has become infinite basically means that the problem has no length scale. You may recall that the correlation function then it's like a power law, and the power law doesn't have any characteristic length scale. Okay? So it's not just that things happen on very large length scales. Actually, the fact that there is no length scale means that what does happen is scale invariant. Okay? So that's the essence. That is actually more like the essence of this critical point, is that the system becomes scale invariant. And Cardi has tried to make these very nice pictures to illustrate this. So let's try looking at them, see if this works. So patience here. Well, we have to wait anyway. Go on. K prime is the step after K. So basically, where you've changed your unit of length from, say, one lattice constant to the block size. Okay, so measured in these new units of length, the correlation length has gotten smaller by a factor of 1 over b, if you like. So let me, maybe I said it wrong. Let's see. It's like the distance between this is a little bit unfortunate.
It's the fixed point. Shouldn't the correlation length also grow?
Yeah, but that's not what happens. K prime is further away from the fixed point than K. Okay, so the correlation grows as you go towards the fixed point, and it gets smaller as you go away from it. So when you do the recursion relation, you go from k to k prime is smaller than k.
But doesn't the recursion relation take us towards the fixed points instead of away from it?
No. No. It's a completely unstable fixed point.
Uh-huh.
So you always move away from it.
Right.
Okay, and so in this case, you're moving, if you're in the, you're moving towards k equals zero on this side, which was the side that we were talking about, and k is getting smaller. Okay. The same kind of argument applies over here, it's just that the flow is in this direction.
Okay.
I mean, if you're starting to the left of this fixed point and you keep doing the recursion relation, it goes that way.
Okay. So it looks to me as if the correlation length is infinite at the
just here.
Just there, but also at the
no. No, and over here it goes to some number. Doesn't grow again.
Oh.
These are attractive. It's only these places where you're always going away that it's well, it's going down, basically. I mean, if the correlation length is decreasing here, that behavior's not going to change.
Well, sure, but I thought like fixed points that have implied like...
There's different kinds of fixed points,
yeah.
Right? There's attractive and there's stable and unstable, if you like.
Okay,
it's the unstable fixed point where you have a divergent correlation length.
And then for stable frequency,
it just goes to some constant. It's like some microscopic. This is, we've said it's some basically microscopic length. Okay, so let's just look at this picture that Cardi's prepared for us, which talks about scale invariance. So the question is what is this? What is this a picture of? Okay. So the left-hand side here, actually both of these panels on the left, are the result. It's some statistical configuration that comes out of a simulation, like a Monte Carlo simulation. It's sort of some typical state of a large system where the little black squares in A correspond, say, to a downspin. And so this is what the arrangement of some region looks like where the black squares are downspins. Okay. So then, what is B? So what he's done in B is he's taken like 3x3 blocks from this panel, or actually from a much larger panel than this. And for every 3x3 block, he's applied the majority rule. So if the majority of the spins are down, then you get a black square for those nine spins were. Okay, and then just the last step, he rescales the picture so that the 9x9 blocks look like one square. So he's rescaled the linear dimension by a factor of 3. And then you're supposed to be able to see that statistically, panels A and B look similar in terms of the distribution of sizes of blobs. Okay? Now, it might not jump out at you unless you compare this to the, if you like, the counterexample of what happens when you're not at TC, when you're not at the critical point. So the right-hand side is essentially the same thing. This is some distribution of downspins, the little squares. But now we're at a temperature which is slightly above TC. Okay? And so then he does the same procedure, blocking together the spins, and then shrinking the size in this panel. And here, I think it is, you may be able to see that it looks like, it looks different, that this looks different from this. This has structure on a finer scale. Okay? So the point is that, And basically, where's the hockey stick? Oh, yeah. I think what he says is that, yeah, is that this picture here, so obviously this had to come from a much larger picture, because to get to this, you shrunk things down by a factor of 3x3. So the block that this came from was like this big. And what he says in the text is that this picture here is this corner. Or in other words, another way of saying that is that this corner is a coarse-grained average of this. Okay? And the point is that you can keep coarse graining and shrinking, and you still get the same look, if you like, or distribution of length scales. Okay, and that's what you mean by scale invariance. Whereas here, if you did this a few more times, it would look like just, you know, a bunch of small blobs randomly distributed.
So, which is also an illustration of the fact that the correlation length is smaller in the, as you go away from TC. Okay, yes, Mary. Well, I don't know if you call it chaos. This has, I think, a different definition. This is what you're saying is that if you were to, you know, work out distributions and moments of the size distributions for this, you would get something that you could characterize by a well-defined scale, which is the correlation length at that temperature. Whereas here, you couldn't. Yes, Ruben. It probably is, actually. Actually, the other interesting thing is that you get this infinite cluster of, in other words, you can define, I shouldn't be winging it like this because I haven't really thought about this very much, but, you know, you can define a connected cluster of spins and, you know, like this is a connected cluster, and here, let's see, over here, it's probably a good place to look at it. You've got these, this, I guess, hard to say. Actually, on this scale, it's hard to say because it looks like it's pretty big. But the point is, you can define a connected cluster as if it's just, you know, this, the black squares are connected, and as T goes to TC, you end up with one infinite cluster of the dominant, you know, of the dominant order. I mean, if the magnetization is going to turn on positive, then you'll get an infinite cluster of positive spins. It might, at TC, it's not actually a finite fraction of the volume, and in that sense, it's fractal. Even though it extends throughout, it's infinite in size, but it doesn't scale like the volume right at TC. So that's sort of fractal-like behavior. Okay, and there's only one of them, of course. Because, yeah. Anyway. Okay. So that's. So I hope this illustrates the point, and I think that the point is scale invariance, that when the correlation length is infinite, the system is scale invariant. Okay? Okay, enough of that. So, thank you. Yes? You mean because the constant, like if it's Ising model going into Ising model, which unfortunately it's not as simple as that, then it would be the same. It would be K star. Yeah, I think that's what you're saying. It's like a fixed point Hamiltonian, yeah. Okay, so let's go on a bit with the theory.
Then my Hamiltonian will only contain the nearest neighbor interaction with the Hamiltonian on the first network. I only have the K1 terms. Is that true? If I think they want to describe the system near the critical point.
I think in some sense that's true because you've got all these other coupling constants will be irrelevant once flow is zero. And so it's only the relevant one that you keep. It may not exactly be K1. I think at this point we should probably go on a little bit more and talk about the theory and what comes out of the theory. So we'll have a language to describe what you're asking about. So, okay, but for the moment I should say that we're sticking to this picture where we're describing everything in terms of a single coupling constant.
Which, as I indicated in my first remarks, isn't a complete or completely accurate description of the physics, that there's a larger coupling constant space. Yes.
Oh, sorry, it's unstable, but it is a.
But I mean, if you're just infinitesimally on either side of it, it is perfectly well defined.
Yeah, but how do you know that approaches the asymptotic large?
That this goes to a. What say that?
As in, how do you know that n is a function of k?
Because goes to infinity
at this point.
Yeah, it's basically because the steps get smaller and smaller. I mean, you know,
yeah,
this
but
is
mean,
a,
the relation we have found shows that the steps go equal length.
No.
You can never go beyond it. You can never go to the left of it. So
if you go to the left of it, you start flowing the other way. So the steps don't stay the same size. They get smaller and smaller, and as you cross this point, they'll start going this way. Okay, so it's, at this point, it doesn't really know where to go, so it doesn't. In fact, if you like, at this point, it goes zero. The steps are of zero size, exactly, because it's a stable fixed point. I mean, it's not stable, but it is a fixed point.
Okay.
Okay, and then as you go a little bit to the right or the left, it starts going off. It's like a...
Sure, we haven't actually shown that, have we?
I haven't told you what the functional form of this MK is, except for the fact that it goes to infinity there. And then sort of there's a new picture where it's going the other way. And you can make the same arguments on the left and the right. OK, so next we'd like to calculate calculate the correlation function as a function of k and the exponent nu near k star. Well, that's it. So basically what we have is k prime is generated by the recursion relation from K. And near K star, we can write this as, we can just expand this function, R of K star, like that. So you can do this. So the point is that everything we've said, nothing that we've said would imply that the recursion relation is in any way non-analytic as a function of the coupling constant. And the fact that the flow diagram separates off into these two parts does not in any way suggest that R
is singular or non-analytic at those points. In fact, it's sort of a basic, it's a basic principle in this RG theory that this function is totally analytic, this recursion relation, and yet it gives rise to the description of the phase transitions. This thing here, by the definition of K star, is K star. Okay, that's the point, just stays there. And so you can rewrite this as K prime minus K star is equal to R prime. Well, actually, you can write it like this, as people like to do in this business. Where this constant is just the the derivative of the recursion relation evaluated at the fixed point, okay? Because that was the coefficient of k minus k star. And we're going to call that b to the y. And that defines y. So y is the log of the derivative of r at the fixed point divided by log b. Okay, so that's the first thing we want to say. Now close to k star, we expect c of k is going to be of the form a k minus k star to the minus nu. OK, that's just the definition of the exponent nu. And also, in general, c of k is b c of k prime. And so this is equal to, well, so this is this, and this is this. So this is equal to B times the correlation function evaluated at k prime. So this thing here is just c of k prime. Okay. But we also have, from the recursion relation, that k prime minus k star is equal to b to the y k minus k star. Okay, so the point is that this is equal to this, and that can only be if these factors of B go away. So B to the 1 minus y nu equals 1. Or nu equals 1 over y. Now, we actually knew this before from that Kadanoff length scaling argument. Okay? We just, you know, did the length scaling. We said that there's this scaling form for both the free energy and for the correlation length, and we inferred from that that the correlation length exponent was 1 over y, which was the, I guess it's the thermal exponent. Okay. So what's different now is that now we know how to calculate y. Okay? Because we get it from the recursion relation around the fixed point. Okay? So y is related to the derivative of the recursion relation evaluated at the fixed point. So that's something completely new. And it basically says how you calculate an exponent. So actually, I think maybe we'll stop a little bit early today, although I'm happy to take questions at this point. It's sort of a natural place. Yeah. On. Sorry? No. Well, that sort of depends. I mean. No, no. Why? Okay, so what are we saying here? We're saying that we did a renormalization based on B. Okay, some block size, some coarse graining size. And we use that to find our fixed point and how things scale, K prime moves away from the fixed point, which we expressed in terms of B to the y. So the point is that the recursion relation depends on B, because it's how much you move when you rescale by that length. And B depends on B, obviously. But the y shouldn't. Okay? It shouldn't matter. Just as in the one-dimensional case, the way that the correlation function behaved as a function of the underlying coupling constant didn't depend on how you blocked the spins together and how successive coupling constants changed. That was all, you know, how they changed depended on B. But in the end, the correlation length as a function of the starting coupling constant didn't depend on B, because that's just a property of the system. So for the one-dimensional case, it behaved properly. There wasn't actually a critical point. It was some exponentially diverging correlation length. But you know, we showed by looking at different cases that it didn't. So here, the issue is simply whether you can calculate, I mean, if this recursion relation for K were the whole story, in other words, that you could calculate the partition function by doing a renormalization that just turned a nearest neighbor coupling constant into a nearest neighbor coupling constant of block spins and so forth, if that were the exact solution to the problem, as it is for the 1D case, then this number wouldn't depend on B. Okay. On the other hand, if you have to make some approximation to get a closed set of recursion relations that you can then evaluate you know, at the fixed point to generate the exponents. Those in general will be dependent on the approximation that you made. And in particular, it'll depend on, you know, it will depend on the size of the block you chose. It'll depend on which additional interactions you decided to ignore. It'll depend on everything. Okay? So,
have a piece that cancels any dependence on B.
For that, yeah, if one had that case, yes.
Okay.
Just as happens in the for the equivalent calculation in the 1D model.
Okay.
Okay.
But like if we can't solve it exactly, then it will depend on our scheme.
Exactly. Yes. Okay. However, what we're going to do in the next lecture is we're going to talk about the case of more than one coupling constant, and we'll sort of work in a space of all possible coupling constants, locate the fixed point, and see what happens there and what determines, you know, the exponents, if you see what I'm saying. So we need to generalize this theory now to be not a one coupling constant theory, but a theory in the space of all coupling constants that are, say, appropriate for the Ising model, generalized Ising model system. So that's where we're going tomorrow. Okay. Any other? Okay, good.